This is Liberty Law Talk, part of Liberty Fund's online library of law and liberty. Your host is Liberty Fund fellow Richard Reinsch. Our web address is libertylawsite.org, where you can subscribe, comment, find other episodes and links related to today's conversation. Our email address is lal@libertyfund.org. Today we are talking with Teresa Bejan about her new book, Mere Civility. Teresa Bejan is Associate Professor of Political Theory in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Oxford, and she's a fellow of Oriel College. Teresa, glad to have you on the program. This is an impressive book, one that I thoroughly enjoyed reading, and wrestling with Thomas Hobbes and John Locke on civility in a new way, and also your thoughts on what some have called a forgotten American founder, Roger Williams, and the Rhode Island colony. And of course, all of this has obvious impact and relevance for today's politics. So looking forward to discussing the book with you. Why did you write Mere Civility?
Oh, great. Well, and firstly, thanks for having me. Why did I write? Well, so I wrote the book. I mean, it's sad to say, but I think I wrote the book for the reason that most academic monographs get written. It started as my dissertation for my PhD, and then and then in the natural way of things, it has turned into my first book. But why I was motivated to write this book, it really came out of a general interest in early modern English political thought. I'd long wanted to work on John Locke, and I'd been really interested in his thoughts on education. But then just in the course of things, it was really just a kind of happy accident. I first encountered Roger Williams in a graduate seminar on secularism that was actually in the English department. And I was just really kind of shocked and really horrified that as a kind of self-styled early modernist, I'd never actually encountered this man before. And so really the project, it bloomed out of this reading of Williams, of getting really fascinated by his life and how that interacted with his theory of toleration. And it just so happened that at the same time as I was kind of feeling my way through Williams, it was recently after the election of President Obama, and there was a lot of talk about civility in the political sphere. And so it was, just, again, it was all these things kind of came together. So I was able to sort of see more clearly than I otherwise perhaps would, a particular way into thinking about the problem of civility as a conversational virtue in tolerant societies. So it was both kind of historical interest and also contemporary political questions.
So I'll my first question really keys off the cover of your book, Two Separate Ends of a Rope Tied and Bound Together, and I'm sure you you picked that image out. I'm sure you did. Thinking about that image, though, it actually produces an interesting first question here. What kind of weight can civility really bear? Can it really tie people with separate opinions together? Can it tie a republic that is fractured together? Or is that, are you arguing that? Or are you arguing something altogether different?
Right. I think probably I should say first, actually, that I didn't choose the cover image. This is a quite funny. I mean, again, this is just I can't thank Harvard University Press and my editors there for doing, enough for doing such a great job. But, I went into this thinking that I'd written an academic monograph on 17th century intellectual history. And then when they came back with this cover design, I was sort of, I thought there was going to be like a woodblock print. I mean, are one of those really, not boring, but perhaps like staid paintings that are so often on the cover of early modern intellectual history books. But no, my editor and the design people at Harvard were much, much smarter. And they really, the cover image of the two ends of the rope tied together, fraying, asking precisely the question that you do, how much weight can we bear and can civility really tie us together? I mean, in picking that image, they really distilled one of the central kind of conceptual insights of the book, which is, what in the 17th century people would have described as the vinculum societatis, the bond of society, right? Today we talk about social bonds. social cohesion. Increasingly, you know, we hear this language of trust. And interestingly, trust was precisely what John Locke proposed as the vinculum societatis. And he had a theory about how civility and sort of, you know, adequate and true civility was a way of building trust. So that is the right question. And then partly what I'm doing in the book is trying to challenge the answer. I think that when we talk about civility, when we appeal to civility in contemporary debates, we very often are appealing to it implicitly as an answer to this question. Civility is what's going to hold us together as our disagreements pull us farther and farther apart. And that is an answer offered by some of the early modern authors I canvass. So John Locke, as I've said, and also Thomas Hobbes has a really interesting kind of negative conception of civility, of civil silence, as a kind of way of preserving, at least superficially at least, a kind of concord or harmony in society. But actually, the answer I favor is the answer given by Roger Williams, which I think emphasizes the importance of civility. It says that civility is really important. Civility has a role to play, but civility alone can't supply the vinculum. Civility is essential so that the disagreements don't divide us unto death, basically. But civility can't rebuild or refasten that social bond. The bond is something that's built in the process of having these disagreements and really, you know, having and conducting the fundamental disagreements that characterize a tolerant society. So really, I mean, I have to characterize myself as a kind of civility skeptic. I think that most of the time that we complain about a crisis of civility, I think the crisis of civility is real, but I really kind of see it as a symptom of a sort of deeper problem, mm-hmm. rather than itself as the cause, the underlying cause, okay. of the problem.
Talk about Roger Williams. You use a great phrase, intolerant tolerationist, I think it was, or something along those lines. Talk about that, and maybe situate Roger Williams in your argument in this mere civility, because as you say, and this is sort of our, you know, as I read and think about civility, it's usually almost kind of a sword that is used really to strike down people whose substantive arguments we don't want to hear from, and we say they're not civil for making these arguments. I mean, that's kind of a practical experience I've had. But I think with Williams, and you know, this is raucous. I mean, this man himself is, I mean, very much committed and in love with his understanding of God, with his understanding of the Bible, and wants to talk about it and write about it and doesn't care who he offends. And then he is banished and goes into Rhode Island, and yet the disagreements continue to multiply. So I think your choice to talk about civility of Roger Williams is really enlightening.
Yeah, it's nice that you call it enlightening. I think some might describe it as perverse.
Illuminating, yeah, yes.
Right. I think that Williams, again, I encountered him really as a matter of chance, but I would have encountered him eventually because he is a figure. I mean, he's a known entity, although I argue that we haven't recognized him for really what he was yet. But the phrase intolerant tolerationist actually comes from a scholar whose work I really admire, Andrew Murphy. And I mean, the point is that someone like Williams is fundamentally intolerant theologically, right? He's not someone, you know, he's what we would like to describe as a fundamentalist, and he has a very strong view of the idea that, you know, some will be saved, and we might hope to be among them, but, you know, many, if not most, will be damned to eternal torment. He is a Puritan, plain and simple. But of course, it's not so simple, because at the same time, Roger Williams, insofar as he figures into the American story, figures as someone we want to describe as a kind of proto-liberal because of the tolerationist arrangements that he came to in Rhode Island. I mean, so I make a lot of this in the book because I just don't think enough can be made of it. The fact that in the 17th century, Rhode Island is the most tolerant society in the world, and, you know, possibly that had ever been. I mean, it's hard to exaggerate the novelty here. I mean, Rhode Island was a society in which there was no established church. And that, you know, so church membership was not tied to civic membership in any way. And so I think some people have read Williams, have seen that and sort of been tempted then to say, oh, well, that's a kind of, you know, that's a prelude to the liberal move of sort of privatizing religion or kind of downplaying or rendering religion indifferent. It's not something we have to disagree about. Religion is a matter of you and your relationship with God. But Williams just does not, if you try to characterize his religious views that way, you're just getting him completely wrong. He doesn't think that at all. He thinks that we have a duty not only to, you know, to argue about faith because it's fun, and I do think he finds it fun. We have a duty because we have an evangelical duty to witness against error and try to save the souls of others. And so it's that kind of, it's that combination, which to many of my colleagues in political theory, and I think many just in the broader public sphere would see, would like to think of as kind of paradoxical, but actually I think hangs together and has a really strong internal logic that I wanted to focus on. And to do so, I mean, and here's the perversity, to do so precisely because Williams is exactly the kind of person that many people appealing to civility today would want to rule out.
So does civility cross over in Williams' mind and become some sort of either natural or theological virtue?
So I think this is really tricky. It's not an either or here. Okay. When he talks about civility, he defines it in strong and kind of essential distinction to what he describes as spirituality. So civility is a kind of virtue of earthly civic communities, as opposed to spirituality, which is, you know, the goodness of the church, you know, the virtue that will get us to God. But of course, that particular understanding of the separation and then the relationship between these communities is itself sort of profoundly theological. I mean, that's he's a Calvinist. There's a kind of Calvinist theology at work here. Now, I mean, so one might then worry, well, okay, Williams has a very peculiar then, and indeed sort of, you know, at least fundamentally theological conception of what civility is, surely that must rule him out. And on that point, I would just say, well, actually, the liberal separation of church and state, it has a lot to do with secularizing that Calvinist logic. So that's one point. But the other point is simply to say that Williams' own theory of what civility is then is more sort of practically orientated. It's something that comes out of our engagements with those who are sort of stuck in this ship of state with us, and they can be of any religion. And civility is a virtue that occurs in our interactions. So it's not really, I mean, in a way, it's ethical, not moral. It's a virtue of behavior that can then be informed or motivated by any number of different theological commitments.
So practically speaking, just thinking about the political angle here, for Williams, we can say all manner of things to one another, how wrong I think you are, how theologically uninformed you are, all this sort of, your political opinions are wrong and will lead to the ruin of our polity. I can say all of those things as long as we keep our guns down. We don't actually come to blows and break the civil peace. We can fully express the depths of our souls to one another on these fundamental questions of politics and religion, and that's fine. But that's it.
Yeah. So I'm sort of guilty of not making something clear in the book that I should have made clear. I mean, so there's one way in which that's right. I mean, civility for Williams is just a commitment to using our words instead of using our swords. Verbal violence is fine. Physical violence is not. And in a way, I mean, that's just a really, you know, I think a lot of self-styled liberals would want to say, yes, exactly. That's the kind of distinction we should have. But I do think that that there's actually an additional way in which civility is a virtue of restraint for Williams. And it comes out in the fact that it's not simply enough that we not use our swords. We have to speak to each other in such a way so that we can continue to speak to each other. And now that's a little bit trickier because you know, one might want to argue that, well, actually, if we want to keep talking, right, we have to be nice to each other, we have to respect each other, we have to do all these things. I mean, I think William thinks that it's more subtle than that. The biggest determinant of whether or not you're going to keep talking to someone else is whether you are committed to keeping talking to them. And that sense that civility places demands not only on speakers, but on listeners as well. And Williams does make a distinction at points. He says, you know, look, there's a difference between calling someone a devil worshiper and saying they're going to hell, which he thinks is fine, and calling them a devil themselves.
Okay.
Right? He does think that we, you know,
separate the sinner from the sin.
But I mean, it's just he draws the separation a little closer to the quick than we might.
He
does view all others as potential converts, but a way of converting someone is witnessing uncompromisingly against their errors. And he also recognizes the ways in which we feel very, very attached and find it difficult to separate ourselves from our errors.
So here's something. Here's something I'm thinking as I read your book. And I'm sure you thought about this, Ms. Bejean. As I read your book, and you use Roger Williams as an example of mere civility, are you not committing some sort of macroaggression against the very idea of civility, though? Because Rhode Island was a failure. Rhode Island was a basket case well into the 19th century. And what? Roger Williams is in his 70s, and the capital is sacked by the Indians that he's tolerated under this theory you've been explicating. And so, as I think, there's just a basic political problem. Maybe we need to read our Thomas Hobbes. What do you say?
Are you accusing me of esoteric writing?
No. I just, as I read your book, I'm thinking, what in the hell is she doing? Rhode Island is a failure. And this is, so anyway, go ahead.
Well, that's wonderful. You are a close reader of text. I mean, so there are a couple points here. And it has been raised to me, and it is something I have thought about a lot. I mean, I think some people read the book and kind of come away thinking that I really dislike Hobbes, or that I think Hobbes is, you know, unserious. But I will say Hobbes is the central chapter. And in fact, I think that there's a lot that Williams and Hobbes have a lot more in common than people think. And certainly, I mean, and this is a more controversial view, I think Williams has a lot more in common with Hobbes than he really does with Locke, which is, the connection that most political theorists and historians of political thought would want to make. They would want to say Williams is kind of a precursor to Locke. I don't think that's right. Williams, by virtue of his position on the frontier, trying to establish a functioning civil society in the new world, with, you know, materials no one would have chosen to do that, right? I mean, today we often talk about, you know, the quote-unquote deep differences that characterize our society. I mean, that's a joke compared to the kinds of differences with which someone like Williams was really dealing, not only cultural, religious, but linguistic. I mean, the very challenge of learning American language, right, so as to be able to communicate. I mean, that, I think, gives him a profound
sense. You say American, you're referring to Native Americans.
Right, Native Americans.
Right, okay.
Right. So,
is that now a new politically correct term? Or, because you used that throughout the book, and I wondered, and maybe I missed your opening sense where you declared you're going to use the term Americans, but I guess that was new to me. But then again, I'm somewhat of a benighted fellow.
It is funny. I mean, so I can't possibly say what the new politically correct.
Well, who can? Who among us really can, right? It changes so fast. Yes.
I use the term American because that's the term that Williams uses.
That makes eminently sensible.
Because in the 17th century, what we call the Native Americans are the Americans. The British settlers of New England are called the New English. And that sense of, you know, who are the Americans, who are the New English, who are the saints, who are the damned. I mean, it's a way of decentering our own and sort of alienating ourselves from this historical and political moment that we tend to think of as kind of original for, you know, modern liberal democracy. In fact, if you sort of actually take it on its own terms, it looks quite alien.
Okay. So Roger Williams' civility works as long as we have a muscular, devoted commitment to it, or to its preconditions. But yet, men are weak. Men are just so very weak and frail. So don't we need Thomas Hobbes, Miss Bejean? I mean, isn't that
the thinker
we really need here?
Continue. I this question of whether or not Rhode Island is a failure. I mean, this is something that I have gone back and forth on myself. I've come to the conclusion that, you know, Rhode Island's not a failure. Rhode Island is an amazing success. I mean, the fact that Roger Williams ends his life having to become a leader of the Providence militia against the Narragansett, with whom he has had long ties of friendship and diplomacy and everything else. I mean, it's this tragedy, right? It's this tragedy of his life. Providence is sacked. His library is burnt. I mean, this is why we don't have, that's why we, you know, books owned by Williams are such a rare find. So much was destroyed. Nevertheless, right, Rhode Island, this colony that he founded accidentally, because he was banished from Massachusetts Bay, and instead of allowing them to deport him back to England, he just escaped.
By the way, you have your rendering of that story. I did not know the full record there, and that was just really nice. I enjoyed reading that account of he just wouldn't shut up and knew that he needed to shut up, but he wouldn't. And so, Rhode Island in the winter, a great vacation destination, I guess. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and it's just, this is the other thing. It's one of my frustrations with people like, Martha Nussbaum, again, I have great respect for her, but just people who've been wanting to kind of revive Roger Williams. And in doing so, they turn him into a boring liberal, basically. The truth is so much more interesting, and it's so much funnier, too. I mean, it's just a great story.
Yeah. So Rhode Island, I would say a failure in a basic political sense, because it can't defend itself against enemies, foreign and domestic. This is my big objection to, I don't know if it's to your book. I mean, it's not necessarily to your book, but it's thinking along the lines of, can civility function and be the glue? And so I'm thinking about Rhode Island. This is why I think you've committed a macroaggression against civility. But what we really need, though, we need civility, because it's like, you know, manners, as I was taught. But what you really need is consensus. You need, some unwritten constitutional political consensus by which a people knows what it is organized in time to accomplish. And that's actually what allows your disagreements not to be so fundamental or threatening to the political order. They're just you working out various means to, you know, your already largely agreed ends.
Right. So, there's a school of thought, and I think it's pretty much right, that a disagreement can actually only occur on the basis of a fundamental agreement. It's not, if there's no kind of consensus on terms or topics of debate or something like that, it's not a disagreement at all. It's just a conflict. So that there has to be some kind of fundamental shared something in order for even a disagreement to proceed. I'm going to disagree with you, but by way of agreeing with you on a more fundamental point, I think.
Okay.
So the point that a successful civil society that has a kind of secure vinculum, that's going to need some kind of sense of something shared, a sense of a kind of constitution in common. I actually think that can be accommodated. And it is actually kind of part of what's underlying Williams' approach. It's just that he's not mistaking the virtue of civility as this kind of conformity to culturally specific norms of respectful behavior for that thing. So in a way, so that's the agreement with you. But then here's the disagreement, and I think it's a pretty significant one. And the move you made, actually, just in expressing your concern, this move from a kind of the need for a constitution to the need for a consensus, I mean, that's the move that Williams would challenge, and it's the one that I would challenge. I mean, the idea that the Constitution that we
well,
must
the
have in
consensus
common,
makes a constitution, a political constitution, possible. I mean, in a way, they sort of interrelate, but there's something unwritten. So in America, right, there's something unwritten that makes a written constitution possible, I would argue.
Well, so I think that, you know, here I'm with Williams in that there's a kind of, you know, the temptation in American politics to sort of creedalize the Constitution, you know, on the one hand, it's like, it's very convenient, right? It's like when we appeal to the Constitution, we can say, oh, look, there's a written Constitution. Go look at it. It says things. And basically, you know, it's a question of whether you sign on or don't, right? Whether or not you're really a member of this polity. I mean, Williams was deeply opposed to the creedalizing of religion and the writing down of creeds for precisely this reason, because as soon as you have this kind of written thing, this written sort of code of doctrines, then you, the human thing that one immediately does is go to one's opponent and says, can you sign on to this? Mm-hmm. And if you can't, then you're beyond the pale, right? I mean, Williams has this insight that says that any person's perspective, any particular person's perspective, and here, you know, I would just remind my, you know, fellow political theorists and my fellow citizens that the government is also made of people. Any particular person's perspective on what the boundary is, on what the, you know, the boundaries of that consensus must be, what the tenets of the creed must be, is going to be partial to his or herself. We're not, there's no kind of impartial point from which to make that judgment. And so it's the peculiar faith of a tolerant society that says, yes, we need to share something in common, but we can't ever allow our kind of answer to what the Constitution must be, that kind of shared thing must be. We can never mistake our answer for that to our answer then of what's beyond the pale, sort of what's then intolerable. And in the book, I sort of distinguish between three questions of toleration, and I describe those as, those are the second and third questions. So if the first question of toleration is how much difference can we bear, then the second question is, well, how much do we have to share in order to make that difference bearable? And then the third is sort of where do we draw the line in our society? I mean, a tolerant society is predicated on the idea that we pull the second and third question apart. And that moves to sort of invoke civility to declare the boundary are really rhetorically moves to just elide those two, press them together, and sort of mask then what you're doing. I mean, in that experience you've had, Richard, of feeling as though people are invoking civility just to shut you up, that feeling you have is precisely a kind of deep recognition of that move that's being made of pressing those two questions
but
together.
I wonder, as I read your book, and I'm, you know, so thinking here, so the tolerant society, things we share, but we're careful about what we're going to actually stick on as a creedal political people. And so, but then there are these questions that emerge and that have emerged in what English history, emerged in American history. How much can we negotiate and compromise on versus insist upon as a way to be a constitutional people? So, you know, obviously in America, there's an idea of federalism, which has been abused, but it's one way to come up with a solution to that. Separation of powers is another one. And yet, you think about just the crucial debate between Stephen Douglas and Abraham Lincoln. Douglas, by my lights, proposes the tolerant liberal of letting people vote slavery up or down. Lincoln is the one who's insisting upon, this is one read, is insisting upon, you know, imposing something he thinks is deeply American, which is the equality of human beings under God and therefore under law. And I think, so Douglas's position would allow for a certain kind of tolerance, but then the question then ultimately becomes, but at what cost? And I think that's, you know, ultimately for me, there is this sense in which the politics of a regime really do shape us all the way down. We really can't get out of it. Or if we do get out of it, we're held together by, I mean, I think this is the Rhode Island problem. You're held together by glue. And who knows as to which person or which group's advantage it is to break the glue to achieve something, because there's nothing really
making you. Evangelical disagreement seems to be an excellent solvent.
Making you one thing, making you one. Yeah. So as I read your book, these are some of the thoughts on my mind.
Yeah.
Locke and Hobbes. And you can, Phil, jump in. Sure.
Yeah, so just I'm so pleased that you brought up the Douglas Lincoln example, because I think that's a really great example to elucidate sort of what's at stake here. I mean, the other things that Douglas does in the Lincoln-Douglas debates is invoke civility. He says, "You abolitionists who are insisting on using religious arguments, bringing your religious arguments into politics, that's very uncivil. You're a bunch of crazed evangelicals." I mean, really,
he had a point.
The thing
yeah,
that Douglas
yeah.
is arguing.
Yeah.
And so that, I mean, in the way in which civility had been used as a way of suppressing the slavery issue, and think, I mean, here, think about the gag rule in Congress, right? The idea that talking mm-hmm. about this fundamental disagreement is too controversial. You know, we have to, we're going to say such discussions are themselves uncivil. And Lincoln just comes in and says, yes, this is, you know, there's some matters of principle are more important than mere civility. And that, I think, is a really crucial point that we always just have to remind ourselves of. And I've been doing a lot of, kind of a review symposia in response to the book, where I've been able to respond to readers' objections. And this is one of the things that's come out really clearly. You know, I'm clear in the book, I think I could make a bigger deal of it. This is a theory of civility. It's not a theory of justice. It's not a theory of democracy. It's not a theory of the just society. All of those considerations, I mean, so I have no problem with the idea that demands of justice, demands of democracy, demands of equality, what have you, trump civility. It's just what I object to is the move of trying to turn your theory of civility into a theory of those other things.
So
I mean,
yours,
that's one of the
yours is a low civility. Ground civility, right?
It is
low,
yeah.
low, really low, but solid ground. Okay, I like that.
Low but solid, and you're just questioning how solid it actually is.
Yeah, how solid it is.
One point I would make, though, and it was really becoming clear to me while you were speaking, is that I think that one of the frustrations that we have with Williams's mere civility and with his kind of highly permissive conception of what a tolerant society should be, is that it is very changeable. It says that, you know, we can't and don't really exercise control over what our society is going to look like, who's going to come in, you know, what, and partly, I mean, that informs the idea of civility. I mean, civility isn't creedal precisely because civility on this model is relative to the community as it is currently constituted, and that constitution will change, because new people and new differences will come in all the time. And so on the one hand, there's necessarily this kind of small c conservatism to this idea of civility as a kind of status quo bias, if you will, a kind of willingness to abide by the norms of your community. But it's not a commitment to preserving the norms of your community at all. And that, I think, is what, I mean, I think that's what you're reacting against. And I think that that's what, I mean, that's why we do, I think a lot of my readers have sort of said, okay, well, now is the time to resort to Hobbes.
I'm goading you. I'm not telling people to resort to Hobbes.
Seriously,
Hobbes, you know, Hobbes sort of makes, it's interesting. Hobbes makes sense now, I think, as I read it, in the sense of, as I look around, and this is my, maybe I'm wrong, perspectival here, progressives in America, EU-crats in Europe, wishing that these sort of basic substantive disagreements that are being had, which are uncomfortable, to put it mildly, and are difficult and visceral and tribal at times, would sort of go away. And could be resolved by them in a very top-down way speech codes would be one way, but sort of just the outlawing of the ability to make these arguments. In an Aristotelian sense, just politically we can't do this. We have shaped the mores in such a way that that there are no really Nigel Farages, and they've sort of failed in that regard. I think, you know, and this is maybe a Teresa Bejan micro aggression against civility. You begin the book with a quote from Barack Obama in 2008. A wonderful, wonderful quote as he could do, give a wonderful summation of something on civility. Yet this is the same president in 2010. We have to win this election so we can award our friends and punish our enemies. When we go to a fight, we bring a gun, they bring a knife. And I come up with some other examples, all of which, but this is a man also, I think, the leading edge of an attempt to really define and shape a polity according to a progressive outlook, while using not merely, not just civility, but sort of an idea. I mean, I think they would say diversity or equality or something like that. And it's sort of like preventing one's opponent from being allowed to speak up because you've ruled them constitutionally out of bounds. And that was sort of like the eruption of Trump in a way, people just sort of rejecting or opting out of that imposition. And so I think Hobbes now becomes interesting in that regard, is that he promises in his nominalistic fashion that the state can define life from the inside out.
I mean, without sort of endorsing every part of what you just said.
Oh, of course,
I mean,
no, of course not. Please do not. Please.
I think that there's, yeah. So one of the things that really motivated me to write the book was precisely, I mean, I talk about this in the introduction, this sort of schizophrenia, or I talk about it in terms of, you know, the sort of the ping-ponging debates about civility, because on the one hand, you have people, and even sometimes, as you say with Obama, the same people, you know, saying civility is the cure for all that ails us. What we need is to elevate our discourse. And part of what it means to elevate our discourse is to make sure those sort of, you know, deplorables don't dirty our discourse, you know, bring the level
up. It's a married white women. Yeah, right.
Yeah. You know, that, so that's one rhetorical move. But at the, on the other hand, a strong sense of civility as a code that's used to marginalize the marginal and to silence dissent and everything else. And so partly what I wanted to do was, you know, I think I'm sure I can't be the first person, but I flatter myself that, you know, I think I have kind of made a real contribution here is to bring those discussions together and actually make the theorists of civility engage with the critics of civility to say, you know, civility does both. To talk about civility is always to be participating in a civilizing discourse. You know, that's what we call in the business of civilizing discourse, the kind of, you know, implicit stigmatization of the other, you know, labeling others as uncivil. And so, you know, so there is a way in which, you know, to starting with Obama, I mean, it's certainly not Obama. I mean, the creed of civility was is a kind of bipartisan creed. You know, I point out that George W. Bush also made it a theme of his first inaugural. But that this is a way of, you know, holding oneself up as a paragon of conversational virtue and implicitly stigmatizing those who would disagree. Now, it doesn't mean that civility then is not some, you know, is not more than that or isn't somehow essential. We do have to have norms. We do have to have a society. We do have to have a civilization. The problem is when we try to impose one particular way of understanding that on others and not giving them a voice, not giving them the possibility of dissent and disagreement. And that's what I really like about Williams. And it seems to me that the Williams position, it wasn't really on offer on any side of the political spectrum. I think that all, and I agree. So, you know, the part of what you said, I really agree with.
He could triangulate.
Because I mean, you know, he's deplorable in very lovable ways. but the kind of the reaction against feeling that one has been defined out of civil society, and by civil here, I mean civilized, right? The idea that the kind of horror that, you know, I live and work in the UK now, and the kind of horror that, you know, we have, my colleagues have, to when we reflect on the fact that certain people who voted for Brexit were educated, you know, at really good universities.
Right.
The kind of
way
that something is broken down in terms of the kind of credentialing function of universities and credentialing our cultural, political, and moral elites. Just always sort of keeping that, I want to bring that part of it into view, not to say that any society can do without it. I don't actually think a society can, but to make us more conscious of when we're doing that and of the negative consequences that might become when we get hoisted by our own petard.
Yeah, no, exactly. thinking here, you know, I, excuse me, I appreciated your book from another angle. I just attended a conference on religion in the administrative state, and several of the papers, we haven't really talked about this, within the United States, I think much more so than European countries, from what I've read, you know, the way we define free speech and who's going to be protected is incredibly wide. I mean, we really do have almost an absolutist approach to free speech, but we didn't always. And that's, and it's relatively recent in American constitutional. It's like the last, since like the middle of the 20th century, where we started this more autonomous understanding of speech. Before that, there was very much a communitarian focus to free speech. And these cases didn't really go to the courts also. I mean, they were sort of decided in local ways. What were local people willing to put up with in terms of what you could say? Mm-hmm. And I think we're actually going to head back to that direction, would be one prediction, because when you're talking to the millennials, professors see this all the time in their examples, whether it's free speech or religious liberty and who should be protected, things that are perceived as just offensive or hateful or make people feel lesser than, students rarely will defend that, which is something new. And I wonder, as I read your book, it is a reminder of space, of giving people space to work things out as individuals with language, with reason, and with a desire to know the truth. And that is why we want to insist upon civility. All the other objections I've raised and you've discussed aside, and I think your book does that nicely and should be part of any millennial's political philosophy reading list in that regard. Millennial political philosophy, such as it is, yours would be an enriching example. So, yeah.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think that for the sake of full disclosure, I must reveal and own myself to be a millennial. So I come in under the cut. So yeah, millennial political theory is precisely what I'm doing. But this kind of sense that there's been a real cultural shift, a generational shift when it comes to understanding the proper remit and kind of limits of free speech. I mean, I find that really fascinating. And, you know, the idea that the kind of absolutist free speech regime that you mentioned is really coming out of a particular moment, really in the 60s, and, you know, a kind of student political movement as well. If we think about generations, it's not an accident that people who remember when, you know, the free speech movement on campus was a leftist movement.
Yes. The defense of religious exemptions used to be a left wing thing. And conservatives always decried it as an attack on law and order.
Yeah,
and that's all flipped now. Yeah.
It's all flipped. And so I am arguing, in the epilogue to the book, I do kind of make explicit the kind of connection between the sort of evangelically tolerant society that Williams envisioned and a kind of free speech absolutist society in the 21st century, in the 20th century. I mean, in a way, that's completely specious. I mean, I'm skipping over quite a lot of history, like quite a lot intervened in the middle there. But I would... say, just as a matter of history and also as a matter of political theory, we need to recognize the fact that free speech rights don't correlate as tightly with a commitment to religious liberty as we tend to think they do. That only comes when one has a kind of evangelical conception of the duties of religion. So, I mean, I'll stick by that point. I think that that's right. But whether or not the tide's going to change, I mean, the worry that I would have, I have no problem. I mean, as a kind of theorist of civility, I don't really have a problem with the social norms changing and becoming more restrictive. What I do have, and this is why ultimately my conclusion is a civil libertarian one, what I do have serious concerns about is the move to make those restraints legislative and legal. The idea that we can somehow legislate civility, that's completely opposite to the kind of virtue that I've recovered in the book, which is a virtue that has to be relative to a changing community, that has to be fluid, that has to be sensitive, that has to, you know, is connected to other virtues like courage and discretion and the judging of people, places, and times, and also one that emphasizes individual responsibility, again, both in speaking and in listening, and says that, you know, we have duties and we have power. You know, responses to offensive speech other than outrage are possible. I mean,
civility is duty laden.
Yeah. And so okay. That, I mean, that's sort of deeper point, which I don't really make explicit in the book, but I've been thinking about a lot more, is in a way, you know, the sort of the rights framework, all the rights talk, it doesn't capture what an early modern evangelical like Williams is talking about, because religious liberty is just as much a matter of duty as it is mm-hmm. of right mm-hmm. In this period. And I think that we could enrich our political discourse and also our understanding of our own history and our own institutions if we really tried to understand those arguments on their own terms. So that's the point, and that's the point that I would put to my students, and do put to my students, and put to the general public, is, you know, the thinking about duty, thinking about virtue, and trying to get us to reflect critically on our legislative impulses. Because I find something wrong, it should be banned. And in doing that, I think I'm doing something sort of fundamentally liberal, but liberal in a kind of older sense.
I think that is a wonderful ending point. Thank you so much for your time. So we've been talking with Teresa Bejan about her book, Mere Civility.
All right. Well, thank you so much for having me. It was really enjoyable.
This is your host, Richard Reinsch, and you have been listening to a podcast that can be found at libertylawsite.org, where you can subscribe, comment, and find other episodes and links related to today's conversation. Our email address is lal@libertyfund.org.